The rest of the afternoon was busy, but peaceful enough. No more trouble broke out south of the bridge, or anywhere else in Whiskey Flats, for that matter. Scratch brought the wounded prisoner back from Doc Summers' place and locked him up, then had plenty to say to Beau about how pretty Velma Dearborn was and how good the food at the Morning Glory Cafe was, too.
By God, it's almost enough to make a man think about settling down. I mean, if a fella could find himself a woman who looks like that and can cook like that, he'd be a plumb fool to pass up the chance.
Beau just smiled and nodded. Scratch said pretty much the same thing every time he was enamored of some lady. Beau knew that when the time came to make a decision, though, Scratch would choose the open trail rather than a placid life in some settlement. Once a man got used to answering the siren call of the frontier, it was hard to ignore for very long. The mountains, the prairies, the magnificent blue arch of the sky with an eagle soaring through it all exerted a powerful pull on a fella. Scratch stayed at the jail while Beau and Riley went to see Mayor Jonas McHale again. McHale wasn't very happy about having to cover the expenses of the prisoners' meals, but he sighed and nodded in agreement to the proposal Beau made.
One thing you can say about Velma Dearborn, she's as honest as the day is long. She won't try to cheat the town when it comes time to settle up with her.
As far as judicial matters went, McHale admitted that he had served as the community's magistrate as well as mayor ever since being elected.
I'm not sure that such an arrangement is really proper, but nobody else wanted the job. Of course, when we didn't have a marshal, it didn't matter who was the judge, because there weren't any cases to try. Lawlessness ran rampant around here. That's not the case now. You've already proven that, Marshal, with your swift and decisive action earlier today.
Well, if you want to schedule a hearing for the prisoners and an inquest for the dead jet in the town meeting hall tomorrow morning, I reckon that would be all right. We'll get it out of the way. No point in waiting.
I couldn't agree more. What will the prisoners be charged with?
Disturbing the peace, I suppose.
Is there a law against firing a gun in the town limits?
Not that I know of.
Maybe that's something the town council ought to take up at its next meeting. You've got to enact some laws around here if you want me and my deputies to enforce them.
That's an excellent idea. I'll sure bring it up with the council. For now, I'll fine those boys as heavy as I can for disturbing the peace. I don't suppose we can keep them locked up for a while?
Depends on whether or not they pay their fines.
Well, I don't suppose we can make the fines unreasonably heavy. We have to be fair about this, even though our goal is to clean up the town by any means necessary.
Don't worry, Mayor. You'll get the hang of all this. Now, we do things by the book now in Whiskey Flats.
Beau managed to keep a straight face at the idea of Riley saying they were going to do things by the book, but it wasn't easy. A short time later, they were on their way back to the marshal's office when they ran into Rawhide Abbott. She had cuffed her battered old hat back so that it hung on the back of her neck by the chin strap and let her auburn curls spill freely around her shoulders. Beau thought she looked mighty pretty, and judging by the semi-stunned expression on his face, so did Jake Riley. Riley snatched his hat off and held it in front of his chest.
Hello, Miss Abbott. Sure is nice to see you again.
Put your hat back on, Marshal. You don't have to fall all over yourself being polite to me.
A gentleman should always be polite to a lady.
I never claimed to be a lady. Deputy Creel, what were you going to do with those prisoners you got locked up?
The fact that Rawhide asked him about the prisoners instead of Riley was a little troubling to Beau. Was she starting to suspect that Riley wasn't actually calling the shots?
Well, we'll hold them tonight and then have a hearing tomorrow morning. Mayor McHale will find them, and if they pay up, we'll let them go.
They'll pay up. Or rather, Dodge Emerson will.
Who's Dodge Emerson? I don't think I've heard mention of him till now.
Emerson owns the Royal Flush Saloon, the biggest and the best place south of the bridge. He's got it in his head that if he can get all the business owners down there to work together, they can stop the law from running them out of town. He'll pay the fines just to get those roughnecks in debt to him.
Now, we don't want to close the saloons down or force the men who own them to leave town. All Beau and Scratch and I are supposed to do is enforce the law and put a stop to all the killing and thievery.
You don't think Jonas McHale will stop at that, do you? He's like any reformer. He wants anything he doesn't agree with gone, and he wants the law to do the dirty work for him. Wait and see if I'm not right.
Well, I don't take orders from McHale, and neither do my deputies.
Actually, you do. You were hired to enforce the laws the town council passes, and they do pretty much whatever McHale wants them to. So he is your boss.
We'll just see about that. The mayor strikes me as a reasonable man. I'm sure he won't overstep his boundaries.
He already had the town council appoint him judge. Seems to me that's grasping pretty tight to power.
You don't like the mayor very much, do you?
He and my father are always rivals, I guess you say. Mikhail never had as much say as he wanted around here until after Paul was gone.
He told us nobody else wanted the job of magistrate. Was that true?
Nobody wanted it bad enough to go up against him. And I don't reckon there's anybody in town who's qualified to be judge, unless it's Harry Winston.
There sure are a lot of names to learn in this town. Who's Harry Winston?
Harry used to practice law here. He gave it up a few years ago, after his wife was attacked by a Bronco Apache, who left the reservation and went on a one-man raid and killing spree. Harry came in just as the varmint was molesting his wife. They fought, and the Apache knocked Harry out. Probably thought he'd killed him. He did kill Mrs. Winston before he took off to look for more victims. I think the hombre wanted to go out in a blaze of glory, and he got his wish when a cavalry patrol caught up to him and shot him to pieces. But that didn't help Harry or his wife. After that, Harry sort of went to pieces too.
Where is this fella now? Is he still here in town?
Oh, he's here all right. Come with me. I'll introduce you.
She led Beau and Riley up the street, and after a minute, it became obvious that she was taking them to Mikhail's livery stable.
Wait a minute. You're supposed to be taking us to see this Winston fella, not the mayor.
He's here.
Rawhide led them into the big barn's cool, shadowy interior. As they started down the wide central aisle, a bandy-legged hostler came out to greet them.
Howdy, Rawhide. Is something I can do for you?
We're looking for Harry, Ike.
Harry? Why, he's back yonder, mucking out that last stall on the right. What in blazes you want with Harry, Rawhide?
Well, we got a question to ask him.
Rawhide motioned for Beau and Riley to follow her. They went along the aisle until they reached the final set of stalls. In the one on the right, a tall, sandy-haired scarecrow of a man in raggedy work clothes was using a pitchfork to heap up a mound of soiled straw. His hands were dirty, and he had smudges on his face. Beau didn't want to think about what those dark brown streaks might be. At first, the man didn't realize the visitors were there. But when he became aware of them, he looked up and blinked bleary eyes behind thick, smeared spectacles that perched on his thin nose.
Well, hello, Miss Rawhide. How are you?
I'm fine, Harry. How about you?
Oh, doing fine. Doing fine, I suppose. Are you looking for Mayor Mikhail?
No, actually, Harry, we were looking for you. This is John Henry Braddock, the new marshal of Whiskey Flats. You may have heard about him.
No, ma'am, I'm afraid I haven't. I don't pay too much attention to what goes on in town these days. I just do my job. I haven't done anything wrong, have I?
No, not at all. We just want to talk to you for a minute. This other fella is Beau Creel, one of Marshal Braddock's deputies.
I'm pleased to meet you, gentlemen. I can't think of what you'd want to talk to me about, though, if I'm not in any trouble.
No trouble at all, Harry. Miss Abbott tells us that you used to practice law here in town.
Oh, that was a long time ago. I don't do that anymore.
But you remember the law, don't you?
Well, certainly I remember the law. I practiced for more than 10 years. A man doesn't forget something like that.
So you know how to rule fairly in a court case if, say, you were the judge?
Of course. But I could never be a judge.
Why not?
Well, I don't know why, but I'm sure I couldn't.
That's why we're here, Mr. Winston. We'd like to know if you'd be interested in assuming the position of magistrate here in Whiskey Flats.
Well, what do you know? I never would have suspicioned that.
Me? A judge? Really?
You're not a drunk, are you?
Oh, no, sir. I don't touch liquor.
He keeps a bottle of opium in his pocket that he takes a nip from every now and then.
Opium? And you didn't figure you needed to tell us about that?
It's my medicine. It helps me forget things.
But you don't want to forget things like the law, do you?
Well, no, I suppose not. But I don't know how to remember some things and not the others.
This isn't going to work. You can see for yourself he can't do it.
Hold on a minute. Harry, you don't mind if I call you Harry, do you?
Not at all. That's my name.
Harry, would it be worth it to you to give up your medicine if you could be a judge?
Beau knew that giving up opium would be rough on the man, but it could be done. They might have to find a good sturdy place to lock him up for a few days while it was going on, but if they could do that...
What's going on back here?
Beau, Riley, and Rawhide turned to see Jonas Mikhail coming toward them, a frown on his face. Trailing behind him was Ike. Obviously, the hostler had slipped off to tell his boss about the conversation the three visitors were having with Harry Winston.
Well, I'm sorry, Mayor. I'll get right back to work.
No, that's all right, Harry. I just want to know what these folks are talking to you about. You can't be serious about asking him to take over as judge.
According to Mr. Winston, he practiced law for over a decade. Most places on the frontier, that makes a fella eminently qualified to serve as a judge.
And you said yourself that it wasn't really proper for one man to be both mayor and magistrate.
Well, yes, but I hardly think that Harry is the right man for the job. I mean, look at him.
I could do it. I think I could anyway.
Are you sure?
I can do it.
Winston reached into the pocket of his filthy trousers and pulled out a small brown bottle of the sort that came from apothecary shops. He held it out to Beau.
Here, you take my medicine right now before I change my mind.
Loco. Plum loco.
You're doing the right thing, Harry.
You'll never get the town council to go along with this. And they'll have to appoint him, you know.
I think you underestimate your influence, Mayor. Well, give us a few days and let us work with Harry. If you see that he can do the job after all, I'm sure the council will go along with whatever you recommend.
Well, I suppose I could keep an open mind on the matter.
Of course you can. Even though we haven't been acquainted for too long, I could tell that's the sort of fella you are. Fair-minded and willing to give a man a chance.
That's true. But we're supposed to have a hearing tomorrow about those prisoners who are locked up in the jail, as well as that inquest.
You can go ahead and preside over those. It doesn't matter a whole lot because, according to Rawhide, an hombre named Dodge Emerson is just going to pay their fines anyway.
That's true. Dodge Emerson takes a particular delight at being a thorn in the side of the respectable citizens of Whiskey Flats. So I suppose the hearing is just a formality. The inquest will be, too, since the dead man was killed by a peace officer in the lawful course of his duties. All right. I'll handle those matters tomorrow, and then we'll see what happens with Harry here. I warn you, though, I still think it's a crazy idea.
Sometimes crazy ideas work out. Look at me. Who'd have ever thought that a handsome devil like me would turn out to be a marshal?
Scratch's eyebrows rose as Beau introduced Harry Winston to him. Winston had cleaned up a little at the livery stable's water trough, but he was still pretty dirty. Scratch didn't offer to shake hands. He just ducked his head in a nod instead.
I'm pleased to meet you, Mr. Morton. I just hope I can live up to the confidence you and Marshal Braddock and Deputy Creel are showing in me.
Uh-huh. This fellow's going to be Whiskey Flat's new judge, huh?
That's the plan. He'll be staying here with us for a while before he takes over the court.
You going to have the barber bring a tub and some hot water up here, ain't you?
We'll go down there. Marshal, you mind staying here for a while and keeping an eye on the prisoners?
Riley pulled the chair back from the desk.
Nope, not as long as you're back before supper time.
Before the young man could sit down, Scratch took hold of the chair and turned it so that it faced the windows.
You might want to put it like that. Always best to have a wall at your back, as Bill Hickok learned to his regret up in Deadwood a few years back.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Beau and Scratch took Winston and headed down the street to the barbershop. The former lawyer shambled along between the Texans. He licked his lips, and his hands shook a mite. Beau figured Winston was getting thirsty for a swig of his medicine along about now. The barbershop was run by an affable, mutton-chop-whiskered man named McCormick. He was a big man, well over 6 feet, and probably over 300 pounds. But like a lot of big men, he had a friendly, gentle demeanor to him. He wrinkled his nose as Beau and Scratch came in with Harry Winston.
Let me guess. You boys want a hot bath for poor Harry here.
Huh. How'd you know?
Ike from the livery stable's already over here spreading the word about how you intend to make Harry the local judge. I like you, Harry, always have, you know that. But I ain't sure you're up to being a judge.
Then we're of one mind, Jerry, because I'm not sure about it either.
Well, I wish you all the luck in the world. Lord knows you deserve a break for a change. Go on back. I keep a tub heated up most of the time, and it just so happens I got one going now.
A door in the back wall of the barbershop led into a canvas-walled rear area where several large galvanized tin tubs were sitting. A small fire burned under one of them, the flames just large enough to keep the water in the tub warm. Off to one side sat a massive iron pot where a larger flame could be kindled to heat the water that was then dumped into the tubs with pitch-lined buckets.
Shuck those duds and climb in, Harry. Bo and me'll see to it that you don't drown.
It's been a while since I had a bath.
We can tell. Go ahead, Harry. It'll be all right.
Well, all right.
Winston took his spectacles off, folded the stems carefully, and handed them to Bo.
You'll take care of them for me, won't you? I don't see very well without them.
Sure. Don't worry about them.
While Winston began taking off his filthy work clothes, Bo held the spectacles up to the light that came through the entrance into the bath area. The lenses were so smeared, it was hard to believe that Winston could see anything with the spectacles, let alone without them. Bo pulled a handkerchief from his pocket, breathed on one of the lenses to fog it up, and began cleaning it. Without his clothes on, Winston was so pale and scrawny, he looked like a fella on the verge of starving to death. He climbed awkwardly into the tub and sank down in the warm water. Scratch used the toe of his boot to prod the pile of clothes Winston had left on the ground.
Mm-mm-mm. We should have got him some more duds before bringing him down here. If he puts these back on, he'll be almost as dirty as he was when he climbed in there.
I can walk over to the general store and pick up a few things for him, if you don't mind staying here and watching him by yourself.
Yeah, I reckon I can handle that, sure.
Bo refolded the spectacles and slipped them into his coat pocket.
I'll be back in a few minutes, then.
He left the bathing area and walked back through the barbershop. A ladder-backed chair sat to one side in the bath area, and Scratch picked it up, reversed it, and straddled it. He reached into his buckskin jacket, pulled out the makings, and began to roll himself a quirly.
You doing all right in there, Harry?
Yes, I think so. Oh, the water's awfully hot, though.
Now, there's some soap there on the edge of the tub. You get it and give yourself a good scrubbing all over.
All right. Deputy Morton...
Scratch heard the footsteps behind him at the same time as Winston spoke. The silver-haired Texan grimaced. He had made the same sort of mistake that he had cautioned Jake Riley against only a short time earlier. He had sat down with his back partially toward the entrance from the barbershop. Not only that, he had his hands full at the moment.
Hey there, mister!
Scratch turned his head to look over his shoulder. Three men had just stepped out of the barbershop into the canvas-walled bathing area. They were roughly dressed, hard-faced men, all three of them gun-hung. In fact, one of the men packed two irons, just like Scratch. And all of them looked like they knew how to use those weapons. The one who spoke had an ugly face, topped by carroty hair under a squashed-down hat.
You're looking for a bath, boys. You're gonna have to wait.
What we're looking for are the sons of bitches who shot up the top notch and killed one of our parts. You're one of them, ain't you? One of those bastards who calls himself a lawman?
What do you aim to do if I am?
We aim to kill you, that's what. And then we'll finish settling the score with your pards.
Ah, well then, boys, I guess you got it to do.
Duck, Harry!
After leaving the barber shop, Bo walked up the street to the Abbott and Carson General Mercantile Emporium. It was a big frame building that took up an entire block by itself, with a long loading dock out front where wagons could pull up and supplies could be stacked in their beds. This bustling enterprise had grown from a tiny frontier trading post, according to Rawhide. That was the way of civilization, Bo reflected. Things always got bigger. Sometimes they even got better, but not always. He climbed up the steps to the loading dock and walked through the double doors that stood open. The store was high-ceilinged and somewhat cavernous inside, with wooden shelves full of merchandise taking up most of the area. More merchandise was in glass-fronted counters along the side walls, and farm implements, tools, ropes, and other goods hung on hooks and pegboards on the walls behind those counters. Toward the rear of the store were huge barrels of sugar, flour, salt, crackers, and pickles. Another glass-fronted counter that ran from one side of the store to the other contained rifles, handguns, shotguns, bowie knives, axes, and hatchets. As far as Bo could tell, a fella could get almost anything he needed to survive on the frontier here. But there were things for the ladies, too, such as bolts of cloth, colorful beads, and other notions, and shelves full of canned goods. Considering the selection of merchandise available, Bo wasn't surprised that the store was doing good business. At least a dozen customers were in the place, being helped by three white-aproned clerks. Rawhide Abbott was there too, which surprised Beau a little. Not too much, though, because he recalled that the young woman owned a half-interest in this emporium. She struck Beau as being canny enough to keep a sharp eye on her holdings. She stood at the rear counter, talking to a man in a gray suit who stood behind it. Rawhide noticed Beau and motioned him back to join them.
This is my partner, Thatcher Carson. Thatcher, meet Deputy Beau Creel.
I've heard a lot about you, lawman.
Carson was a little below medium height, clean-shaven, with sleek iron-gray hair and the face of a terrier. His brisk accent marked him as not being a native Westerner. Beau pegged him as being from Massachusetts or somewhere else in the Northeast.
I'm glad to see that someone's finally going to make Whiskey Flats a decent place to live.
Town strikes me as already being a decent place to live, Mr. Carson. Just needs a few of the rough edges sanded off.
Indeed. And all of those rough edges are south of the bridge. You made a good start, Deputy. Keep up the good work.
Were you looking for me, Beau?
No. As a matter of fact, I came to get some new clothes for Harry Winston. He's over at the barbershop getting a bath, and those rags he was wearing aren't fit for man nor beast to put back on.
Amen to that. Thatcher can fix you up.
I certainly can, Deputy. What did you have in mind?
Maybe a white shirt and a plain black suit, a tie, and some socks and underwear, of course. A couple of shirts, I guess. We want Harry to look like a judge once he's himself again.
You've acquired yourself quite a project, Mr. Creel. I always liked Harry Winston and wish only the best for him, but it may be too late.
Somebody's got to bet on the long shots.
I suppose so. I'll gather up those clothes myself.
Seems like a nice fella. Probably pretty efficient, too.
You got that right. Thatcher's a regular eagle eye when it comes to watching the pennies and making sure that the stores run right. There's no way I could have kept it going by myself. I reckon my father knew that, and that's why he set things up the way he did. How's Harry?
Getting cleaned up, and that's liable to take...
Gunfire erupted somewhere down the street, filling the late afternoon air of Whiskey Flats with the sounds of violence once more. Scratch dropped the tobacco pouch and paper as he exploded into action. His right hand flashed to the ivory-handled grips of the Remington on that hip. As he spun toward the gunman, his left hand reached down and grabbed the top rung of the chair's back.
Yeah!
He dropped into a crouch as he slung the chair at them. The roar of shots pounded against Scratch's ears as flames jetted from the muzzles of the revolvers wielded by the would-be killers. A bullet whistled past the silver-haired Texan's ear, and more of them clawed through the air near his head. But then the chair crashed into the man who was firing two guns and knocked him backward. That gave Scratch just enough respite to plant a slug in the middle of Ugly Face's chest. The carrot-topped gunman rocked back and then forward. He tried to raise his gun for another shot, but instead his knees unhinged and he pitched forward. By then, Scratch had filled his left hand too, and that Remington blasted twice. The first shot narrowly missed the third gunman. The second shattered the man's elbow on his gun arm. He grabbed at the injury with his other hand and staggered to the side. That left the two-gun hombre who'd been knocked off balance by the chair, which had also busted his nose from the looks of the blood streaming from it now. As he caught himself and started to raise his guns again, he found himself alone, facing a grim-visaged Texan, who also had two guns. Unwilling to match his Colts against Scratch's Remingtons, the man did the only sensible thing. He turned and ran. Scratch could have shot him in the back as the man galloped out through the barbershop. He considered the idea very seriously for a second before lowering the Remingtons. He'd never been a back shooter and was too old to start now. Behind him, Harry Winston stuck his head up from the water in the tub. Winston had held his breath and gone under when the shooting started. Now that the blasts had stopped, he blinked soapy water out of his eyes.
Is it over?
I reckon.
Scratch was pretty sure Ugly Face was dead, and the man with the shattered elbow had fallen to his knees and was whimpering as crimson rivers continued to flow down his arm. Scratch stepped over to Ugly Face and towed the hombre over onto his back, just to make certain. He was looking into the glassy, lifeless stare in Ugly Face's eyes when suddenly...
Look out, deputy!
Scratch jerked his head around and saw that the other man had managed to get to his feet. In his left hand was a long-bladed knife. The man started to bring the knife down in a killing stroke. Scratch still had both guns in his hands, and he tilted up the barrel of the right-hand Remington and fired. The bullet caught the man in the throat at a rising angle and then bored through his brain to explode out the back of his head. The varmint dropped like a puppet with its strings cut.
Now it's override enough. For those two stupid bastards, anyway.
What about the other man?
Sounds like somebody's dealing with him right now.
As Bo ran out the double doors of the Emporium, he could tell that the shots came from the barbershop where he had left Scratch and Winston. He couldn't see any reason why anybody would want to hurt the drug-addicted former lawyer, but some of the lawless element in Whiskey Flats might have seized this opportunity to try to rid themselves of one of the new lawmen. Bo was still a block from the barbershop when a running man burst out the front of the place. The man carried two revolvers, but didn't look like he had any more interest in using them. He looked around frantically for a second, then pouched the irons and started to walk away as if he hadn't had anything to do with the gun battle behind the barbershop. Bo felt a little better now. The man had dashed out of the barbershop as if the devil himself were behind him. It hadn't been the devil that had chased him out of there, Bo knew, although the fellow responsible was called Scratch. If the hombre thought he could fool anyone by his casual pose, he was sadly mistaken. The townspeople who were near the barbershop had seen him run out, and so had Bo. The Texan strode toward him determinedly. Bo was going to arrest the man and find out if there was anything behind this gunplay besides mere vengeance. Suddenly, a single shot rang out behind the barbershop. Bo didn't know what that was about, but he thought the report sounded like one of Scratch's Remingtons going off. Whatever it was, it galvanized the gunman on the street into action again. He clawed his Colts out as he broke into a run and craned his neck to look over his shoulder, clearly afraid that somebody was going to come after him. He should have been looking in front of him. Bo planted himself in the street.
Hold it!
The man jerked toward him and swung the guns up. Bo had no choice but to pull his own Colt. For a long moment, the gunman managed to stay on his feet, swaying drunkenly. But then his eyes rolled up in their sockets and he collapsed. Bo shook his head in disgust. He had wanted to take the hombre alive. Scratch emerged from the barbershop while Bo was walking over to the man he had just killed. The Texans met at the corpse, looking at each other over the gunman's body.
You all right?
Yeah. You?
Yeah, fine. It's Frog's hair. Can't say the same for the two fellas lying dead behind the barbershop, though.
What about Harry?
He was still in the tub when I left. He might shook up, but he wasn't hurt.
So there were three of them, eh?
Yeah. Claimed to be friends of the hombres we shot earlier in the day.
I suspected as much. I would have liked to question one of them, though, just to be sure.
Well, why'd you just kill this one, then?
Wasn't time not to.
Quite a crowd gathered around the Texans as everybody wanted to know what the shooting was about. Rawhide and Thatcher Carson appeared, having followed Bo out of the general store.
Where's Harry?
Still back yonder behind the barbershop, taking a bath. I reckon one of us better get over there and keep an eye on him, Bo. With all the shooting going on, I wouldn't put it past him to run off and try to hide somewhere.
Not Harry. He's not a coward. He's just had some bad luck and made some bad decisions.
Bo was about to ask Rawhide to fetch Ed Chamberlain, the Undertaker, when Jonas McHale pushed his way through the crowd.
Oh, good Lord. Now there are gun battles on this side of the bridge. I expected Marshal Braddock to put a stop to this sort of thing.
It's all connected. This hombre and the two Scratch killed over at the barbershop were friends with the men we shot earlier. You'll find that bringing law and order to a town isn't an easy process, Mayor. One thing leads to another, and another, and another.
Where is the Marshal, anyway?
I'm right here.
Jake Riley walked up as the crowd parted to let him through. He carried a rifle that he had brought with him from the marshal's office.
I heard the shooting. What happened, Bo?
Bo sketched in the bloody events of the past few minutes for Riley, musing as he did so that the young man had been careful to wait until all the shooting seemed to be over before emerging from the marshal's office. No one else seemed to have noticed that, however, and Bo certainly wasn't going to bring it up.
Scratch and I would have arrested them, but they didn't give us a choice.
Four killings in less than a day.
Well, that's the sort of thing you have to expect when you bring in a fighting marshal like me, Mayor. Things are liable to get worse before they get better, too.
I wish you hadn't told me that. I suppose you're right, though. Progress doesn't come cheap.
The curious crowd spread out even more as Ed Chamberlain arrived, driving his meat wagon. The little Undertaker looked as cheerful and cherubic as he had earlier.
Business is booming in Whiskey Flats today.
Your business.
With a shake of his head, McHale walked off toward the livery stable. Bo watched him go, thinking that the mayor's reaction was all too typical. Folks wanted their messes cleaned up, wanted justice done, but usually didn't want to have to see the bloody price that was often paid to do such work. Bo, Scratch, and Riley left Chamberlain and his helpers to do their grim work. Riley headed back to the marshal's office while the Texans returned to the barbershop. Jerry McCormick, the proprietor, was sitting in his own chair when they came in, gingerly massaging a swollen lump on his forehead.
Oh, get all three of the bastards.
Yeah, we did. Glad to see you're all right. I saw you slumped in the chair when I went out, and I hope the hell those varmints hadn't stoved your head plumb in.
Ah, the ugly one buffaloed me with his six-shooter as soon as they came in. I reckon they didn't want me calling out a warning to you.
Ever see any of them before?
I don't know. There are always a lot of hard cases like that around town. It's hard to tell one from another.
Well, there are three of them who won't be causing any more trouble. Son of a gun. I forgot to get those clothes for Harry. I was just about to do that when the shooting started.
Bo went to the door, intending to return to the general store and get the new garments Thatcher Carson had been gathering for him. But when he stepped outside, he saw Rawhide walking toward him, carrying a paper-wrapped package.
Is that what I think it is?
Harry's new duds. Here you go. I'll wait out here.
Bo took the clothes inside, and he and Scratch walked back to the bathing area. The bodies of the two gunmen still lay there, with flies starting to buzz around them. Harry Winston peered nervously over the edge of the tub. His sandy hair was plastered to his head by the water.
You clean?
I think so. It was hard to wash up with those two lying there like that.
Why? They can't hurt you or anybody else now. Anyway, you gotta be cleaner now than when you got in there. Come on, haul them spindly shanks of yours out of there and get dried off and put these duds on.
A few minutes later, Winston was dressed. Thatcher Carson had thought to include a pair of shoes in the package, which Bo had neglected to mention. Winston didn't wear the tie, but he donned the white shirt and the dark suit and looked considerably different from the filthy, ragged scarecrow he had appeared to be in the livery barn.
Where are my spectacles? Like I told you, I can't really see too much without them. I was sort of glad of that, so I didn't have to look too close at those corpses.
Here, I tried to clean them a mite, but I don't think I did a very good job.
Well, that's all right. The world's looked rather blurry to me for a long time now. That was always the way I liked it.
As they left the barber shop, the former lawyer was licking his lips again, Bo noticed, and tiny beads of sweat had begun to pop out on his forehead.
What now?
It's getting close to supper time. Let's get you something to eat and maybe some coffee.
I don't know. I'm not very hungry. I'm not sure I can eat anything.
You'll feel better if you do.
Especially if you eat at the Morning Glory Cafe. This Dearborn's got the best food in town.
I seem to remember that. Velma Dearborn was friends with my wife. She made really good biscuits.
And she still does. Come on, Harry. Time to start putting some meat back on them bones of yours.
Ike the hostler must have continued running around town spreading the news, because when Winston and the Texans went into the cafe, Velma came out from behind the counter to greet Winston with a hug.
Harry, I think it's just wonderful that you're going to be the judge. You're cut out for something a lot better than mucking out stalls. And the town will be better off with a real judge, too.
I just hope I can live up to that.
We came to get something to eat for Harry.
And I reckon we could do with a round, too. It's might early, but it's never too early for a good meal.
Come on, then, all three of you. We'll go out into the kitchen. Won't have to carry the food as far that way.
They sat around the table where Velma and her cook, a handlebar mustachioed Swede named Borglund, took their meals. Borglund's accent was so thick that Bo and Scratch could understand only the occasional word he spoke. But they gathered that he was glad to meet them, that it was good to see Winston looking so respectable again, and that he would be more than happy to serve them all the pot roast, new potatoes, and boiled carrots that they could eat. He said that he would fix them something that sounded like lutefisk, too. But behind his back, Velma made a face and shook her head, so Bo and Scratch declined the offer as graciously as possible. Velma seemed able to communicate with the Swede just fine, so she got him busy cooking while she poured coffee for Winston and the Texans.
I really don't have much of an appetite.
Hush up with that, Harry. You know you never could turn down my food.
No offense, ma'am, but it appears that Mr. Borglund there is the one who's doing the cooking.
From my recipes? I think I have some biscuits left over from lunch that haven't gone stale yet. Would you like to start out with one of those, Harry?
Well, I'll try.
Winston took out a handkerchief that Carson had tucked in the breast pocket of his coat and blotted sweat off his forehead. Velma took a biscuit from a basket that was covered with a piece of linen and handed it to him. Harry nibbled on it, not seeming to take much interest in the food. Velma looked at him for a moment, then turned to Beau.
I think we could use a little more firewood for the stove, Mr. Creel. Would you mind stepping out back with me to bring some in from the woodpile?
It would be my honor, ma'am.
You know that Harry's been drinking that damned opium almost ever since his wife died, don't you?
Yes, ma'am, we do. He says he's willing to give it up, though, if he can be Whiskey Flat's judge.
That stuff's harder to give up than liquor, from what I've heard.
Depends on how much booze a fella's accustomed to putting away, I reckon. I know it'll be a rough next few days for Harry, that's for sure.
You can't leave him alone. If you do, he'll find a way to get some of the stuff.
Yes, ma'am, I expect he will. We've been thinking about that very thing. What we need is someplace to lock him up.
You can't do that. Harry's got a sensitive nature. Lock him up, and he's liable to go plumb loco, as the cowboys say. You need a place where somebody can look after him all the time, and I don't think you can do that while you're busy being lawman.
No, ma'am, probably not. If you got any suggestions...
Leave him here with me.
With you, ma'am?
My living quarters are here in the same building as the cafe, and I've got a spare room. Harry couldn't leave without coming out through the cafe, and either Ole or I would see him and stop him. He wouldn't fight us.
I don't know, Velma. I've seen men do some mighty bad things when they really got a hankering for that stuff.
You don't know Harry Winston. He wouldn't hurt anybody, no matter how bad a shape he was in. I tell you, he's got the gentlest soul of anybody you ever met. But there's a core of steel somewhere inside him, too. I'm convinced that it's still there. If he wants to lick this thing, he can do it. At least he can with a little help, and Ole and I can give it to him.
It wouldn't do much for your reputation. A man that you're not married to stand here with you?
Oh, please. You think I give a fig about my reputation? Anybody who knows me very well will know that there's nothing improper going on. And those who don't know me? Well, they're the same sort who came sneaking around after my husband died, hinting about how they'd be happy to help out, me being a widow and all, and having cravings. Oh, people like that can just go to hell as far as I'm concerned.
You make a mighty strong case, ma'am. I reckon if it's all right with Harry, it's all right with scratching me.
Can you speak for Mr. Morton that way?
Oh, I think I can.
Bo gathered up an armload of wood from the woodpile, since that was the excuse Velma had used for calling him out here, and they went back inside. Winston had managed to eat about half of the biscuit Velma had given him, and he had taken a few sips of the strong black coffee. Bo thought he looked a little better. Not much, but a little. Bo postponed breaking the news until after the three of them had eaten. The pot roast was excellent, moist and tender, and the potatoes and carrots were savory. Winston only picked at his food, but he ate some and managed to drink a whole cup of coffee. When the meal was over, Bo looked at Winston.
Harry, how would you feel about staying here at Mrs. Dearborn's place for a few days?
But I have a place to stay, at the livery stable. Mayor McHale didn't just give me a job, he lets me sleep in the loft, too.
Well, you'll be more comfortable here, Harry, and Ole and I can help you out if you get to feeling bad.
Well, you don't think the mayor would mind?
I don't think he would. I don't care all that much what Jonas McHale thinks anyway, do you?
Well, he's been good to me. But if you think it'd be all right...
We all do.
Bo saw Scratch frowning at him from across the table. Winston didn't seem to notice that, and Scratch stopped frowning when Bo kicked him lightly in the shin.
Oh, ooh, yeah, you go right ahead and do that, Harry. Heck, I'd jump at a chance to eat Miss Dearborn's cooking three times a day.
You can do that anyway. You don't have to live here.
Yes, ma'am.
It's settled then. Scratch and I will leave you here, and if you need anything, Harry, anything at all, you just send somebody to find us.
All right. Thank you. It's been a long time since anybody really trusted me to do anything. I'll try not to let you down.
I don't expect you will.
Was that your idea?
Nope. Velma came up with it all on her own. She and her husband were friends with Harry and his wife. I expect she just wants to help him.
Lucky fella getting to spend all his time with a woman like that. Me, I'm stuck with an old mossy horn like you.
Well, that goes both ways, pard.
After all the excitement of the Texans' action-packed first day in Whiskey Flats, the next 48 hours or so were relatively quiet. They made their rounds along with Riley, who only occasionally made some impatient comment to Beau about wanting to start figuring out some way to cash in on this sweet deal they had stumbled onto. Beau kept putting him off, saying that they had to build up more trust from the townspeople first. The next morning, after the shootout between the Top Notch and the Lariat, Mayor McHale held a hearing in the town meeting hall and fined each of the participants in the fracas $50, including the ones who were still laid up at Doc Summers' place. A lawyer named Carruthers represented all of the men and paid their fines for them. Instead of one inquest, there were four that morning, following the hearing. Ed Chamberlain was the local coroner as well as the undertaker, which was only logical, and the jury he appointed wasted no time in finding that the deceased had met their ends in an entirely legal manner, that is, being gunned down by the very star packers they were trying to kill. The proceedings were short and simple, with no lawyers to complicate and prolong them.
Carruthers works for Dodge Emerson. Emerson's the one who provided the money for those fines, I'm sure of it.
Emerson himself seemed to be keeping a low profile. Even though the three lawmen had visited the Royal Flush Saloon several times during their rounds, they had seen no sign of the owner, and the bartenders always responded with headshakes when asked if Emerson was there. The Top Notch and the Lariat remained closed. The former because the owner, Big Mickey Tilden, was still recuperating from the serious bullet wound he had suffered at Riley's hands. The Lariat's proprietor, Fred Byrne, was a nervous sort of gent, according to Rawhide, and might have decided to pack it in after the big shootout. Or, she speculated, it was possible that he just didn't have enough of a liquor stock left to open again, hundreds of bottles having been blasted to pieces while the bullets were flying around. In fact, everybody south of the bridge seemed to be on their best behavior. There were only a few minor fights in the saloons, and no shootings or stabbings. It was the quietest stretch that section had seen in months, McHale told Beau, Scratch, and Riley, as he chatted with them in the marshal's office.
I don't know whether to be thankful or hold my breath waiting for the real storm to break. Because that's what it feels like, the calm before a bad thunderstorm.
I guess folks are behaving themselves because my reputation has preceded me.
Now, if this keeps up, we may not need Harry Winston to take over as judge. We may not need a judge at all. How's Harry doing, by the way?
He's getting there. I expect he'll be fine in another day or two.
As a matter of fact, though, Winston had been going through pure hell, and Beau knew it. He went to the cafe a couple of times a day to check on the former lawyer, as well as take his meals there. The first 24 hours, Velma had been grim-faced when Beau asked her about Winston as they shared a cup of coffee in the kitchen.
It's the torments of the damned he's suffering, Beau. He can't keep any food down, and he shakes and sweats all the time. I never saw a man so miserable. And every time I think he's starting to do a little better, it gets worse again.
Has he tried to get out?
He told Ole to tie him to the bed in the spare room. So that's what we did. We only let him loose when he tries to eat. Poor man, he's weaker than a kitten. I'm not sure he could walk even if he was loose.
Don't let him fool you. I've seen fellas who were just as weak and sick as Harry is toss grown men around like they were kids' dolls. When that sickness comes on them...
Maybe it won't. I'm praying that it won't get that bad.
I'll put in a good word with El Señor Dios myself.
With the prisoners having been released, there was no need for someone to stay at the jail all the time. Eventually, though, that problem was bound to come up again, and Beau had been thinking about it. He told Scratch and Riley about his solution as they sat in the office early in the evening of their third day in Whiskey Flats.
I got an idea. We need a jailer so we won't be stuck here every time we have to arrest somebody. How about Rawhide Abbott?
That loco redhead?
A woman jailer? I never heard of such a thing.
Now, you seen for yourselves. She's plenty tough.
Yeah, I remember that punch that laid me out. For a little thing, she packs a hell of a wallop.
And she can handle a gun, too. Got steady nerves.
She showed that when she went into the Lariat with me. But dadgummit, Beau, I'm just thinking about the sort of things prisoners would be liable to say to her.
From what I've seen of her, she'd probably just cuss right back at him.
Yeah, I reckon that's true, too. Maybe it's not as far-fetched an idea as I thought it was at first.
Well, then, if we're in agreement, should we go find her and ask her if she'd be interested in the job?
Still got reservations, as the old chief said, but I reckon we can give it a try.
they left the office and went looking for Rawhide. She lived in a comfortable, good-sized house on the edge of Whiskey Flats that her father had built many years earlier when he first married Rawhide's mother, who had also been a red-headed beauty. Since both the general store and the Clarion brought in money for her, she didn't have to worry about a living. From the gossip Beau had heard, most of the unmarried young men in town had tried to court her at one time or another, but none of them had had much luck. Rawhide seemed content with her life the way it was. Beau had a feeling that a challenge would appeal to her, though, and that was what the job as jailer would represent. She didn't need the wages and might even refuse to take them, but he felt like she would accept the job. Abbott and Carson was still open, so the three lawmen went there first. Rawhide was in the store talking to Thatcher Carson, as they had thought she might be.
Is there some sort of new trouble?
No trouble, but we have a proposition for you.
I've heard that before.
No. I'm talking about a job.
You want to hire me? To do what?
To be the jailer. Keep an eye on the marshal's office whenever none of us can be there.
You want a woman to be the jailer? Not that there's any reason a woman couldn't be the jailer.
Forget it, Thatch. I reckon most men would say the exact same thing if they heard what Deputy Creel just said. I just got one word for you boys. No, I take that back. I got two words. Hell no.
You won't take the job?
As jailer? Nope. Not interested. But if you want to make me a deputy, then maybe we can talk about it.
A deputy? I think I should go over the books before we close down for the night.
Carson went through the door behind the counter that led into the store's office. That left Rawhide standing there with the Texans and Riley.
Well, how about it?
Well, I don't reckon that occurred to us. What do you think, Marshal?
I couldn't pay you. Mayor McHale complained enough about having to come up with the wages for Beau and Scratch.
I don't care about the wages. I've got plenty of money. But I think it'd be fun to be a deputy. Shoot. That's pretty much what I was that first day when we had to break up that war between the Lariat and the Top Notch.
You know, it's liable to be dangerous.
The day you got here, when all that hell started popping, was the most entertaining day in Whiskey Flats in a long time. Don't worry. I'll take my turn guarding the prisoners whenever we have any. I just don't want to be stuck there in the office all the time while the rest of you are out where the excitement is.
Well, you seem to have an answer for everything. I guess I'm within my rights as a marshal to appoint you as a special volunteer deputy.
With all the powers of a regular deputy.
With all the powers of a regular deputy. Leastways until somebody in higher authority says different. Now, I can't give you a badge, though. Don't have any except the one I'm wearing.
That's all right. Just make sure everybody knows that I'm a peace officer now, too.
I've got a feeling you'll take care of that anyway.
Deputy Abbott. I like the sound of that.
Just don't get any ideas about making it Marshal Abbott. I'm still the Marshal around here.
For now. For now.
Rawhide insisted on making their evening rounds with them, and since there were now four of them, Beau suggested that they split up, two taking each side of the street. Before Riley could suggest that Rawhide go with him, Beau jumped in.
Rawhide, you're with me.
He didn't want the two of them spending a lot of time alone together. Rawhide was a smart girl. She might tumble to the fact that Riley wasn't actually who he was pretending to be without either Beau or Scratch around to cover for him. Riley looked a little disappointed. Beau knew that he was still attracted to Rawhide, despite the fact that she had given him absolutely no reason to think that she might be interested in him in a romantic way. Just the opposite, in fact. But Riley didn't protest, and so the foursome split up, Beau and Rawhide taking the left side of the street, Scratch and Riley the right. They made their way south along Main Street and crossed the bridge. That section of town was quiet again tonight. It didn't stay that way, though. As Beau and Rawhide approached Emerson's Royal Flush Saloon, which, like the Abbott and Carson Emporium on the other side of town, took up the front of an entire block by itself, glass suddenly shattered ahead of them. The man who had just been thrown through the saloon's front window sailed across the boardwalk, crashed through the railing, and landed hard in the street, rolling over a couple of times before coming to a stop.
Sweet Lord of mercy! Who could have tossed a fella hard enough to do that? He's back in town. Blast it!
Who?
Before Rawhide could answer, A massive, shaggy head was poked out through the broken window.
Did I kill him? Did I bust him to pieces? Damn Tinhorn tried to cheat me.
Men crowded around the bat wings inside the saloon to peer out curiously as Bo hurried to the side of the man who had been tossed through the saloon window like a rag doll. Having heard the commotion, Scratch and Riley came running from the other side of the street. The unfortunate victim had come to a stop on his belly. Bo knelt beside him and rolled him over. The giant, looking out through the busted window, withdrew, evidently disappointed that the hombre he had manhandled so roughly was still alive. The man's face was already swelling and turning dark with bruises. His attacker must have cuffed him around some before flinging him through the window. Bo tried to lift him into a sitting position.
He's probably busted a few ribs when he went through that railing. We'll need to get the doc down here, as well as a wagon to load him in, more than likely.
Riley looked at the crowd on the boardwalk just outside the saloon's entrance.
One of you men fetch the doctor! Now!
None of them budged, though, until another man stepped through the crowd.
Do what the marshal says, Rance. You take care of him.
Yes, sir.
That's Dodge Emerson. Reckon the commotion finally drew him out of his hidey hole.
There was nothing Bo could do for the injured man, so he straightened and turned toward the boardwalk. The man Rawhide had indicated was only medium-sized, but the body in the light-colored suit was muscular enough so that he seemed a mite bigger than he really was. He wore a silk vest and cravat, as well as the suit. His hair was dark and sleek in the light that spilled from the saloon, and a thin mustache adorned his upper lip. The corners of his mouth quirked as if he smiled frequently.
I'm sorry about this. Looks like one of my customers was celebrating that it got him hide out of hand. I'll be glad to pay that poor man's medical bills. Is that you, Miss Abbott?
It is, and that's Deputy Abbott to you, Emerson.
Really? As of when?
Tonight, and don't you forget it.
Oh, I'm not likely to forget something like that. You know me. I keep close tabs on what goes on in this town.
Bo nodded and gestured toward the injured man.
We want to talk to whoever's responsible for this. He's going to have to come down to the jail with us and be locked up to face charges of assault and attempted murder.
Oh, I don't think any murder was intended.
That's where you're wrong, friend. We all heard the big galoot who flung him out the window asking if he'd killed the poor son of a gun. Sounds like attempted murder to me.
You're welcome to come in and talk to whoever you like. This is a public place, after all, and you folks are the law.
I'm not sure this is a good idea.
Why not?
See that mule at the hitch rack?
Bo looked and saw probably the biggest mule he had ever seen in his life. It was so tall and massive, he was surprised he hadn't noticed it before now. But he'd been a little distracted when that hombre came flying through the window.
I see it. Are you saying that mule belongs to the fellow who did this?
That's right. He lives alone up in the mountains and doesn't come down in town very often. But whenever he does, there's usually trouble. Folks have learned to steer well clear of him. I guess that gambler's new in these parts and didn't know any better than to try to cheat Chesterfield Pike.
Chesterfield? The man we're after is named Chesterfield? How much trouble can it be to arrest him?
With that, Riley stepped onto the boardwalk, strode past a clearly amused Dodge Emerson, slapped the bat wings aside, and disappeared into the saloon.
Oh, Lord. Bo, Scratch, go after him. He didn't know what he's getting into.
Neither do we, ma'am.
Scratch and Bo hurried after Riley, with Rawhide bringing up the rear, looking unaccustomedly anxious. The crowd inside the big bar room was still buzzing about what had happened. The first thing Bo noticed, though, was that everyone in the Royal Flush was giving one gent standing at the bar a wide berth. He needed that room, because his shoulders seemed as broad as an ox yoke. He towered over everyone else. Jerry McCormick, over at the barbershop, was a big man. But next to this fella, McCormick would have seemed puny and undersized. The man wore a homespun shirt that was stretched dangerously tight over the bulging muscles of his arms and shoulders. Crammed down on his head was an old brown hat that had seen much better days. Nicks had been cut from the brim, and in one place, Bo would have sworn that someone had taken a bite out of it. The man wore no gun, but a long, heavy-bladed knife was thrust behind the length of thick rope that he had tied around his waist to serve as a belt. With his reach, if he ever started flailing away with that pig sticker, he could lay waste to a large area around him. Bo imagined that blood would flow like water in a fight like that. Not that the giant probably had to resort to his knife very often. He could probably win most fights just by swinging those long arms with the ham-like fists on the end of them. Of course, when you got right down to it, neither prodigious strength nor a razor-sharp blade were any match for 6 bullets from Colonel Colt's great equalizer. But if you ever went to shoot that big fella, you'd want some distance between you and him, because Bo had the feeling he could absorb several lead pills and keep right on a-coming. Even dying, Pike could choke a man to death in a matter of seconds or break him in half. There was no time to explain any of that to Riley, because the young man had planted himself in the middle of the room and called out over the hubbub.
Chesterfield Pike! In the name of the law, I'm looking for Chesterfield Pike!
Scratch cast a glance toward Bo, who knew very well what his trail partner was thinking. For a smart man, Riley could be pretty damn dumb at times. There was only one man in here big enough to have picked up that gambler and tossed him so casually through the front window, and that was the giant at the bar.
Lord God Almighty, you seen a beanstalk growing anywhere around here?
Big as he is, that fella's real. He's not something out of a fairy tale.
Damn it, somebody tell me where I can find Chesterfield Pike!
The man at the bar had a large, full schooner of beer in front of him. When he picked it up, it looked sort of like a thimble in his sausage-like fingers. He downed the whole schooner at one gulp. Then he turned slowly and brushed at his ear.
Sounds like a gnat buzzing in here. Anybody hear that same annoying little noise?
Riley took an angry step toward the bar, but then it finally dawned on him just what a behemoth he was facing. He couldn't back down now, not in front of a whole saloon full of people, many of whom heartily disliked him because he had a lawman's badge pinned to his coat.
Are you Chesterfield Pike?
I am. Who are you? And why are you looking for me?
Well, I'm the law in Whiskey Flats. Marshal John Henry Braddock. Did you throw a man through the front window a few minutes ago?
You mean that tin-horn gambler who tried to cheat me? Well, I wouldn't call him a man. More like a puny little bug. He's lucky I didn't just squash him underfoot.
He'll be lucky if he doesn't have any more than 3 or 4 broken ribs. And if the swelling in his face goes down, he may start to look human again in a week or so.
Nobody cheats Chesterfield Pike.
Well, how would it be if I arrested him for being a crooked gambler?
You do that?
I'm told you spend most of your time up in the mountains, Pike. You probably didn't know that we've got law and order here in Whiskey Flats now. But we do. Me and my deputies are responsible for enforcing it, so, yeah, we'll arrest that fella just as soon as Doc Summers says he's healthy enough and see that he pays a proper fine for what he did.
Why, that's mighty decent of you, Marshal.
There's just one thing, Mr. Pike. Since I'm the Marshal, I have to enforce the law fair and square for everyone.
That makes sense, I reckon.
That's why I have to arrest you, too. You see, what that gambler did was wrong, but what you did was just as wrong. Maybe more so, because you're so big.
Well, I never have cottoned to being put in jail. Fact of the matter is, I never seen a jail that could hold me.
I know you don't like it, but it's the only fair thing to do.
You know, Chesterfield, what the Marshal is saying makes sense.
It does?
I'll tell you what. You trust me, don't you, Chesterfield?
Well, you ain't never steered me wrong, Mr. Emerson.
Why don't you go with the Marshal and his deputies and spend the night in jail? Now, I know for a fact that if you do, you'll get breakfast tomorrow from the Morning Glory Cafe.
Miss Velma's place? Oh, I do like Miss Velma's food. That's a plum fact.
All you have to do is get a good night's sleep, have a good breakfast, and then go to a hearing and pay a little fine, and I'll take care of that for you. How does that sound?
It don't hardly sound like being in jail at all.
You'll do it then.
Well, I sure will. Now you got my word on it.
There you go, Marshal Braddock. Chesterfield's word is his bond.
Yeah, well, how do I know that?
Because my word is my bond, and I say you can trust him. That ought to be good, unless you want to call both of us liars.
I don't reckon anybody wants to do that. Mr. Pack, would you come with me?
I'd rather go with Miss Rawhide. Didn't I hear her say that she's a deputy now, too?
That's right, Chesterfield, I am. You're not going to give me any trouble.
My ma raised me to be a gentleman around ladies. And Mr. Emerson, he says that you're a lady, even if you don't dress like one, don't always talk like one.
He says that, does he?
I always try to tell the truth.
Come on, Chesterfield. You'll have the jail to yourself tonight, unless there's any more trouble.
Pike went peacefully, lumbering along behind Rawhide. Bo nodded for Scratch to follow them, and then he and Riley lingered for a moment in the saloon.
I'm obliged to you for your help in handling that big fella, Emerson. Things could have gotten ugly if you hadn't stepped in like you did.
You don't know the half of it, Marshal. But Chesterfield has always liked me and trusted me, so I thought I could get him to be reasonable. A man as big and short-tempered as he is, people just expect him to be loco all the time. But if you stay calm and treat him fairly, he's generally not too much trouble.
He's not right in the head, is he?
Well, he's smart enough, but he just doesn't know as many things as somebody his age usually would. Anybody who takes him for dumb would be making a big mistake, and it might just backfire on him.
What about you?
Now, I never claimed to be smart.
No, I mean, why did you help us out? You're supposed to be the one who's getting together all the saloon owners and such south of the bridge to keep law and order from coming to Whiskey Flats.
Someone's misinformed you. Sure, I think all of us down here could do better if we quit trying to cut each other's throats all the time. There's nothing wrong with some healthy competition. But gun battles like the ones between the Top Notch and the Lariat the other day don't do anybody any good. Mickey Tilden's laid out with a gunshot wound. Fred Burns slunk out of town with his tail between his legs, and four other men are dead. Killed by you and your partner, I hear.
They didn't give us any choice in the matter.
I'm sure they didn't. But if you law dogs think I'm behind any of that, you're dead wrong. I'm just a mostly honest businessman trying to get along the best I can. I don't have any quarrel with you or your deputies, Marshal.
That's good to know. Come on, Bo.
They left the saloon, and as they went through the bat wings, Bo glanced back and saw Emerson watching them with hooded eyes as he lit a cigar. Bo didn't know what to make of the saloon keeper. If Emerson was telling the truth, he might not be as much of an enemy as Bo had expected him to be. On the other hand, the man could be a slick liar. He could have even been behind the attempt on their lives a few days earlier.
What do you think?
I don't know. Not sure what to make of it.
I am. Sometimes it takes a crook to know a crook, and believe you me, Dodge Emerson is as crooked as a dog's hind leg.
I reckon we'll see. Right now, I want to make sure that Scratch and Rawhide got that Pike fella locked up all right. His night isn't going to be as comfortable as what Emerson made out it would.
Why not?
You've seen the bunks in those cells. Pike's going to be hanging off both ends.